And we're ready for our next case, which is case number 68819, Las Vegas Land Partners LLC versus NYPE. Is that what it is, NYPE? Micah, help me on this one.
Yeah, Your Honor, we called it Mr. Knight.
Knight.
Your Honor, counsel, we're responding to this. I'll say.
All right, great. Welcome, everybody. Mr. Eccles, Mr. Reisman, welcome to the Supreme Court.
Good morning.
Mr. Eccles, you're on first, representing appellants.
You may proceed. Good
morning, Your Honors. Micah Eccles here for appellant. This is a case where the district court compensated Mr. Knight as if he were a real estate professional, but then didn't require him to be licensed under NRS Chapter 645. And today I just want to focus on NRS Chapter 645 and the quantum merit arguments, possibly the securities arguments if we reach them, and any questions that the court has. So,
Mr. Eccles, before you get too far into this, as a kind of a pre on this, activities that were involved, did they actually take place in the state of Nevada, or did they take place outside of the state?
I think both, Your Honor. There definitely were activities that took place within Nevada, and that were also after the June 1, 2006 date, after Mr. Knight left his employment with First Wall Street. I can go over some of those, or I can just point to the briefs where we've kind of set those out. In the opening brief on page 43 to 54, there's a little bit more of a narrative there about the before and the after. And the reason we did that is because from the panel order from the first appeal, the panel said, well, we need to know what the purpose, or what was contemplated in the different acts that were going on. And then in our reply brief, if you start on page 2, there's a shorter list where we've combined some of those to pages 2 and 3. We've put up 8 bullet points, but some of those are combined. So there's actually about a dozen reasons. All we need under NRS 645-260 is one act. And so it's a really interesting statute for this case. It's not one that was mentioned in the previous appeal. If you read that order, it's not mentioned in there. And so basically what 260 says is that if there's one act that constitutes a broker salesman, it basically poisons the well. So once you have, even if it's just an offer, if it's just an attempt to do something that could constitute a real estate activity, then the whole transaction is a real estate activity. Some of the things that Mr. Knight did, I'll just go over these briefly. He held himself out to be a real estate broker salesperson. He actually convinced Land Partners to leave First Wall Street because he said, hey, First Wall Street has a problem, they're not licensed, implying that he was, and then he also represented directly that he was. Interestingly enough, though, he only got his New York real estate license about the time when he left First Wall Street in June 2006, but he never got a Nevada license for real estate. He never associated with anybody in Nevada. And so, in our view, Your Honors, the relief we ask for right out of the gate is to reverse the entire award based upon the licensure issue.
Mr. Eccles, what effect does the Supreme Court order previously entered have as far as law of the case on some of these licensing issues? Can you give us your thoughts on that?
So the order basically identifies that there is a factual issue. When Judge Israel granted summary judgment to us, he basically said the end result was a land purchase agreement. Therefore, the activities leading up to that necessarily must be real estate related. The panel order from the first appeal said, no, we need a factual determination on whether there were some acts within the statute, some acts without the statute. If you look at cases like Dichter or Zhang, which say it cannot, a Supreme Court order cannot be law of the case unless it addresses the precise issue. The precise issue that the prior order did not address was the 2601 Act issue. And so there can be no severability because of the plain language of that statute. Let me mention a couple more things around the pages of our brief, which record cites. Mr. Knight said he wanted to be the exclusive broker for Land Partners in dealing with anybody who was going to be interested in partnering up or purchasing the land or developing, entering into the development project. He also offered to be the exclusive agent for the leases, which is now where the RTC sits and where Las Vegas City Hall sits. So he was undoubtedly performing real estate activities in Nevada for a Nevada piece of property. An interesting thing in the first Wall Street agreement, so there was first there was a letter of intent, then there's a first Wall Street agreement, which is June 2006. On the first page of that, which is page 213 of the record, it talks about forming an LLC and that the purpose of forming the LLC is to develop the project.
And but so that wasn't Knight's activity. That was among the two parties to form an LLC. And I'm not sure I saw anywhere in the record that that was initially contemplated.
So, and that's an interesting point, Your Honor, and you're exactly right, that First Wall Street agreement was between Land Partners and First Wall Street. Now, what Judge Israel does is something that's kind of interesting. In his findings of fact, they really are internally inconsistent. If you read the first part of the order, it talks about, you know, it gives a history of the case, there's a First Wall Street agreement. Then he talks about a Knight contract. And what he tries to do, but he doesn't quite get there, he tries to say that the parties actually agreed to adopt the first Wall Street agreement, meaning Knight and Land Partners. That never happened, though.
Well, that's why it was quantum merely, because there was no contract.
Exactly, Ron. But there are several points throughout the findings of fact, conclusions of law document, where he refers to a Knight contract, even though there wasn't one. If Mr. Knight has the ability to recover something and that there is a quantum merit issue, in other words, he's not barred by NRS Chapter 645, the next step of argument is you go to the quantum merit. And really our relief that we ask on this could be in two steps. The first step would be to reverse based upon the lack of substantial evidence or reverse and remand for a new trial. And we have a whole host of issues in this quantum merit. One of the main arguments is based upon this court's Las Vegas Sands versus Suen case, where it talks about, yes, there was some benefit conferred, but there was no evidence to demonstrate how that was calculated, or how that can possibly be supported by the number the jury reached. We have the same issue in this case. The judge awarded Mr. Knight $2.6 million as quantum merit. The way he calculated that was he said, well, I'm just going to look at the first Wall Street agreement, to which Knight was not a party. And he said, I'll just take the 4%, 1% discussion that's in there. That's also what Mr. Knight's expert testified to, which is also similar to the Suen case. So the only reasonable or fair market value that Knight's expert was able to come up with was based upon that contract. He didn't have any sources outside of that first Wall Street contract. And So as alternative relief, we ask for reverse and remand based upon the same reasons as Zoom. So Judge Israel gave the entire value of about this 1 year period between Land Partners and either First Wall Street for the first 6 months and then Knight for the next 6 months at $5.2 million. Instead of saying, well, let me evaluate the reasonable value of the services provided, quantum merit situation, he just said, I'm just going to cut this in half by time. Whatever was under First Wall Street, Knight can't recover because he was an employee. The right doesn't belong to him. Anything that happens after June 1, 2006, he can recover. So we would have expected him to say, okay, well, here are the acts that he performed, because he's not being compensated as a real estate professional, but what he's trying to be what he says he said he's a finder, a term that's really undefined, which looks and sounds like a real estate professional. So what the judge does is he says, hey, first 6 months, half the money, last 6 months, half the other half the money. But he doesn't give us any valuations. He doesn't give us the evidence. He doesn't give us the valuations. Another thing he does that was error was instead of calculating the 4% on the capital, he gives 4% on both debt and capital. And what this ended up being is the $5.4 million number that the judge came up with, it almost made Knight as if he were a principal, because what the judge notes in his findings of fact is that there was a little over $10 million to the two principals, David Mitchell, Barnett Lieberman. And so here you have these two gentlemen receiving about $5 million each, and then Knight receiving half of $5 million, but he hadn't contributed real property or anything else. All he was a finder. And so there's a serious problem on the equities here as well. And I see my time's running out. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
You have about 3 minutes and 40 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respectfully ask this court to ponder one question in deciding this appeal. One question. If the evidence is uncontroverted, as it truly is here, that throughout the type of Knight's performance, neither LBLP nor Forest City intended to accomplish their development partnership through a land sale, then how could Knight have possibly been acting in furtherance of a land sale? The logical answer to this question is that Knight couldn't have been acting to further a land sale. That's what the district court found, and that finding is supported by the following substantial evidence. At trial, and this speaks volumes, neither Mr. Mitchell nor Mr. Lieberman ever testified that they intended to sell the property, that they hired Knight to help sell and lease the property, that they instructed Knight to assist in the selling or leasing of their property, or that Knight's duties included selling or leasing their property. In fact, LBLP consistently represented to Knight that it would not be selling any of its real estate as part of the transaction. The stated purpose of the First Wall Street Agreement was for LBLP to engage First Wall Street to act as an advisor to LBLP, quote, in connection with its intent to find a joint venture and or equity partner for the redevelopment of the property. The FWS agreement doesn't state that First Wall Street is to assist with the sale of real property, and it defines, notably, it defines the, quote, transaction as, quote, raising equity and or debt capital from the partner. David Mitchell specifically admitted that, quote, a land sale is not contemplated in the FWS agreement. Similarly, the LOI doesn't mention the sale of real estate. Instead, stating the structure of the transaction between Forest City and LDLP will be the formation of a limited liability company. Mr. Mitchell also admitted that the LOI involved a capital investment and not a sale of land. The concept of accomplishing LDLP's and Forest City's development partnership through a sale of real property was raised for the first time, and this is uncontroverted, by David LaRue of Forest City to LDLP in or around mid-November 2006 when Mr. LaRue proposed a tenancy in common structure for tax reasons. This structure was determined by LDLP and Forest City without Knight's involvement or knowledge. Again, that's uncontroverted. Accordingly, all of the evidence is uncontroverted that throughout the time of Knight's performance from approximately December of 2005 through November of 2006, LDLP didn't intend to sell any real estate, and Forest City didn't intend to purchase any real estate. Therefore, I ask you, how could Knight have been acting to sell LDLP's property? Knight couldn't have been. That's why the district court reasonably found that Knight was acting to further a business relationship, not a sale of property. LDLP and Forest City, and this is an important point, always had control over the structure that their business relationship was going to take. And Knight was always excluded from the structure of determinations. In fact, Mr. Mitchell instructed Knight not to involve himself with the structure of the transaction. For these reasons, the district court reasonably found that at sporadic points in time, during Knight's almost 12 months of performance, he mistakenly may believe that the development partnership might be accomplished through a land sale or might need a real estate license or that he might be performing brokerage services. But it's uncontroverted, again, that in each one of these cases, Mr. Mitchell quickly corrected Knight and informed him that he wasn't selling real estate or performing services that needed a license. I'm going to turn, unless you have any further questions in that regard, I'm going to turn to Quantum Merowith.
Yeah, and I'm interested, counsel, in the damage calculations. Mr. Eccles pointed out this debt component in the calculation. I'm interested in why you believe the judge correctly.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I will absolutely address that. The district court's quantum merit damages award is based upon substantial evidence. It's a substantial evidence review. The district court properly considered all the services that Knight performed, and again, these services that for which he was seeking compensation were from June of 2006 through November of 2006. These services were all performed for LVLP's benefit and were done at LVLP's request. And the district court correctly adopted the 4%, 1% success formula as the lesser of market value and a price that the defendants had expressed a willingness to pay. In these situations, in which the services are performed at someone else's request and benefit the requester, the quantum merit is not based upon the value of the benefit received, but based upon the value of the services performed. And the standard is usually the lesser of market value or price that the defendants had previously expressed a willingness to pay. And here, LVLP had expressed its willingness to pay the 4%, 1% success fee on multiple occasions over the course of Knight's performance. First, in the January 2006 FWS agreement. Then, after the FWS agreement, after the introduction, mind you, Mr. Mitchell had a phone call with Mr. Knight on the eve of January 1st, in which he again expressed a willingness to pay the 4%, 1% success fee for the post-introduction services that Knight would be performing after June 1st. And then again, towards the end of Knight's performance, on October 5th, now Knight was excluded from the transaction about a month later in early November. As late as October 5th in an email, Mr. Mitchell again expresses a willingness to pay Knight the 4%, 1% success fee for his post-introduction performance. The market value, again, lesser market value versus price of expressive willingness to pay. The market value of Knife Services was actually, and Dr. Wiles testified to this, 7.5% for equity capital and 1% for debt capital, which actually would have equated to $9.6 million for his post-introduction services. And again, Dr. Wall's value opinions all apply to Knife Services after June 1st, 2006, after the introduction, after the first Wall Street agreement. The district court chose to apply the 4%, 1% formula because it was a price that the defense expressed the willingness to pay over and over again. But what he decided, he said, you know, 50% of these services were performed under First Wall Street, were performed by Knife during the First Wall Street Agreement, so I'm going to cut this award in half. So the 4%, 1% would typically be $5.2 million, because approximately half of these services were performed during First Wall Street, and the other half were performed by Knife post-First Wall Street. I'm going to give 50% of the 4%, 1%. Now, this is reasonable. The court was there.
Essentially, concession that reflected there were communications between Knipe and Mitchell that Knipe had an expectation of being paid under the FWS agreement.
Your Honor, there were ongoing communications that Knipe expected to be paid in accordance with the terms of the FWS agreement. The court, however, found that there was no contract based upon the FWS agreement. It found that it didn't adopt wholesale the FWS agreement. It just said the FWS...
A tool as a measure of damage.
Exactly. It's evidence of value. It's one of multiple expressions of the 4%, 1% success fee that LVLP had said it was willing to pay.
But Knipe was not a party to that agreement.
No.
So... doesn't your opponent have a point under the Suen case that should not have been considered?
No, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't agree. The Suen case is actually very broad. The Suen case says, and the court can consider any other evidence of value in there. So it doesn't have to just consider expressions of willingness to pay. It can consider anything else that's of value. I would say at a minimum that the First Wall Street Agreement is evidence of what the value of the services are because they involve the same services. But even beyond that, I think it arises to the category of it was an expression of what FWS was willing to pay for the capital raising services involved here. And beyond that, I think that whole argument raises form over substance because Knipe was the one that brought in LVLP as a client. Knipe was the one that said, hey, we should bring First Wall Street in the picture, maybe expand our ability to reach people. And Knipe was the one that performed all the services with regard to bringing Forest City to the picture here.
Well, and I guess in October, in the email where there was a communication from Mitchell that he was willing to pay that fee, that had nothing to do with the FWS agreement as it was over by then.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Did I answer your question about the debt versus equity?
No.
Okay, let me answer that, and then I'll be done, okay? I apologize. So it was 4% for equity capital investment and 1% for debt capital investment. And Dr. Wiles, who's a PhD in finance and teaches master's accounting and MBA programs at North Carolina Chapel Hill, said that equity capital, just the standard term in the industry, equity capital is any money that's used to purchase your equity interest in a company. And it's irrelevant whether it's borrowed or whether or not you pay straight in cash. For example, if I purchase a car for $30,000 and I pay cash, that's equity capital. If I purchase a car for $30,000 and I pay $10,000 in cash and I borrow $20,000, that's still equity.
I know that, but what's the relative values for raising debt capital versus equity capital?
And
I just want to understand, Mr. Eccles made that point, and I know there's a difference in the two, at least
absolutely.
My understanding is, if you could explain that.
So here's how this worked, and I hope I'm answering your question. It's a little complex. So $126 million $234,000 in total equity capital was committed by Forest City as follows. $101 million at the initial closing in June of 2007 at 4%, because that's equity capital, was used to purchase their 60% ownership interest in the tenancy in common, is $4,045,112. Bear with me, please. Then there was $25,105,866 in subsequent commitments of equity capital, money used to purchase the equity interest, and at 4%, that equates to $1,004,000. And then there was $16,824,822 in debt capital that was committed by Forest City after the initial closing. And at 1%, that's $168,248.22. That totals $5,217,000, the judge reasonably said 50% of your work was done under First Wall Street, you're not entitled to it, I'm going to cut that 4%, 1% in half, and I'm going to award you $2.6 million.
So the judge made a different allocation for raising equity capital versus debt capital, then, is what you're saying, how these calculations...
No, respectfully, Your Honor, no. I believe what he did is he applied the 4% for equity, 1% for debt success fee to the total amount of equity and debt capital that was committed by Forest City, and it came up with $5.2 million. But then he said, I'm trying to determine the reasonable value of your services, and you're only seeking the value of your services for the 6 months from June to November. You were acting with First Wall Street from January until May, so you can't recover for those services. So if the total services are 4%, 1% of $5.2 million, then I'm just going to divide it in half to pay you for the 6 months.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Any other questions?
On that point, did your expert testify that this compensation formula was consistent with compensation formulas generally in these kinds of transactions?
In the capital raising entry, yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eccles, rebuttal. 3 minutes and 40 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So counsel started out by saying there's no evidence in the record that Knipe ever contemplated that there would be a real estate deal. But he did quote partially from finding number 36 on page 12166, which says, the few sporadic times in which Knipe appeared to mistakenly believe that the transaction might be accomplished through a sale of real property, and then it goes on to say, are insufficient to overcome the weight of the evidence that Knipe did not act for the purpose of furthering the land sale. Now, that's an interesting finding, because it raises two issues.
You said finding 36 from the court's findings?
Yes, it's on page 18 of the findings of fact. It's record number 12166. It might be in the... It's actually in the conclusion.
I was going to say, I don't think that's the findings.
It started over with the numbering. So that conclusion of law, which would be reviewed de novo, raises two interesting statutory issues. One is it grafts into NRS 645.030, the definition of real estate broker, a mistake. So it provides a defense of mistake in the statute, which doesn't otherwise exist here. It also violates the one act rule, because it says, oh, he might have done these things under a state of mind. And so what the judge is really saying here is that, yes, he did those things, but we'll give him a pass because we don't think he knew what he was doing.
What rule does it violate? I'm sorry, I missed the first
part. The one act rule. Which I talked about in my opening part of the argument.
Right.
So the evidence was not uncontroverted on that issue. So if you look in the sections of our opening brief, and then again in our reply brief where it talks about Wiles' testimony, he was not a real estate expert. He was asked, can you apply these numbers and everything you're talking about to a real estate situation? Because I'm not a real estate expert. Knight had a real estate expert, was John Knox, but they chose not to call him on trial. But another interesting point is that Wiles didn't differentiate between the first half, the second half of this relationship. And so the only number he could come up with was an all or nothing number. Really where the 50% number comes from, it doesn't come from any evidence in the case. What it comes from is Judge Israel just guessing. And that's where we have an issue with Mort Wallen. Because while we recognize that Mort Wallen says there's a range that a trier of fact can use to determine damages, there must be an evidentiary basis for that. And the evidentiary basis is the certified fire protection, the mountain of case law from this court on what is quantum error. And that just wasn't done in this case, Your Honors.
Why isn't the allocation of the services between the FDS period and the time that Knight was involved adequate in the record? That's what the judge relied on. So he's simply allocating the time.
Well,
how does that violate fire protectors or any of the other jurisprudence on quantum merit? I don't see that.
At a minimum, we should get credit for the $375 we paid in First Wall Street. But there was nothing that identified the specific services and affixed any values to those. And I realize, Your Honor, the authority of the Flamingo case, which was cited in some, but that was for real estate professionals. And if he wants to be compensated like a real estate professional, then he had to be licensed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rick. Court, thanks, Mr. Eccles and Mr. Reisman, for your arguments and briefs in this matter. Very good job by both of you. This matter will stand submitted, and I wasn't sure if I said that for the first case in Forest Grove.
That'll stand submitted also.
That's what happens when you get older and you can't remember. I see, everybody. We'll be back at 11:30.